Okay, this week we are looking at the Sridhar Aish, who comes next chronologically. Last week we looked at Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, the Achiezer. He died in 1940. So, as we discovered, he saw the storm clouds gathering before the Shoah. And the Sridhar Aish, he actually experienced it. He was born in Poland, educated in the classical Litvish Yeshivot, the Mir and Slobodka. He then had a rabbinate for a short while in Poland, and he went to Germany. Germany, he became university educated as well. And eventually became the rector of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, which is also where Rav David Zvi Hoffman was the principal. We discovered a couple of weeks back, and that was the training ground for German Orthodox rabbis in the 19th and early part of the 20th century. He was then expelled from Germany in 1939, ended up in Warsaw. He was kind of lucky in the sense that because he had Russian citizenship, so that saved him from being deported to the concentration camps. And after the war, he ended up in Switzerland. His life was, after the war certainly, was a little bit tragic, a little bit reclusive. He could have had any number of rabbinical positions in all sorts of places, primarily in Israel. He was offered opportunities to be Rosh Hashiva, offered opportunities to be professor at Bar Ilan. Neither of those satisfied him. He sort of bridged two worlds. It was in Berlin at the Hildesheimer Seminary, where he really felt most comfortable in terms of a combination of the yeshiva and the university combined into one. If he'd gone to Israel and just been a Rosh Yeshiva, he'd have felt constrained. If he'd just been a professor at university, he'd have felt constrained. Interestingly, he was approached about rabbinic positions here in London in the 1930s, when eventually Dinah Bramsky was appointed as head of the London Bet Din. He was one of the people who was also approached. At that time, he was optimistic about the future in Germany, hoped that the troubles would pass, and wasn't interested in coming. After the war, he was again considered a possibility as a chief rabbi after the war, or as a halachist on the Bet Din. And again, he wasn't interested in that. He had a small yeshiva in Montreux after the war. His notable Talmidim, he had many notable Talmidim, but from our perspective, Talmidim of interest to us were pre-war in Germany was the late Rabbi Dunner, who was the senior rabbi of the Adas Israel. So he had certain traditions from the Sridhar Aish. And so that was one of his notable Talmidim, and various others as well. He ended up at the end of his life, as I say. The other notable Talmid from an Anglo-Jewish perspective was Rabbi Rakov, who was the previous Gateshead Rav. Both of those personalities, Rabbi Rakov and also Rabbi Dunner, both very firmly entrenched in the Haredi world, leaders of the Haredi community in this country. Nevertheless, Talmidim of the Sridhar Aish, who of course himself was bridging a gap perhaps between two worlds. Professor Mark Shapiro, I think he's got an association with Yeshiva University. If not, anyhow, he's an American. Wrote a very interesting book on the life of the Sridhar Aish a couple of years back, called Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy. And it describes how the 3 days was was straddling two worlds, and in many senses trying to reconcile the two of them together. He's got a couple of volumes of Shelot and Tshuvot, largely dealing with contemporary issues in one form or another. So less of the sort of classic questions that have been tossed around back and forth for the past 800 years. Questions to do with Mashiv HaRuach or how to do your Schach on a Sukkah or those sorts of things, which we've pointed out sort of appear in the Chazam Sofer and appear in Rabbi Akiva Eiger and appear in Rav Moshe Feinstein and many of the classic works. But the 3 days discusses those issues far less. He's got a lot on the question of stunning animals before Shechita. We touched on that at the end of last week's share when we were looking at the Achiezer of Rav Chaim Isaac Grudzinski, and in the sort of years leading up to the Second World War and the Shoah, where there was agitation against ritual slaughter. The 3 Day Eish discussed this in great length, and there's a lot of correspondence that he had with other Gedolim of the time on that issue. And we've got quite a number. I want to go through a number of Shelot and Tshuvot this evening, which reflect issues that were important in his time and equally important today. What he says is not necessarily the last word, but certainly factors to consider in the equation. Let's start off with a question that we've seen addressed by other poskim previously, and that was, where may a Shabbat desecrator be part of a minyan? We saw the view of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman a couple of weeks back, who had a permissive approach to this, particularly on combining two considerations. It's a consideration that it's not clear that the person's got the din of being Mechalel Shel Farhesya if you haven't got 10 people, 10 observant Jews who've witnessed him being Mechalel Shabbat. And then also the consideration that it's possible that nowadays a person who goes to shul and says kiddush and associates with Shabbat rituals, it's not clear that they are trying to deny that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a creator of the world. The 3 Day Eish is actually a little bit stricter than those opinions. Al dat sheilato. So, as far as your question, in mutalat minyan, are you allowed to incorporate in a minyan somebody who is married out? Sorry, I lie. This I put my title here, a Shabbat desecrator, but of course it's a person who's married out, which is a somewhat different question. Ayin Baruch Chaim, shemutalat saif avaryan. You're allowed to include in a minyan any a transgressor, provided they haven't been put into cheirem, excommunicated. Rakim hu munudeh. It's only if a person has been excommunicated, you're not allowed to include him in the minyan. The Prima Gadim says this applies only to a person who's transgressed what we call the Te'avon, not because he wants to anger HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because he actively wants to rebel against Halacha, but he can't walk past a McDonald's without stopping in for a fluffy McFlurry that's on his way to work in the morning. It's not that he wants to anger HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's just he's got a big taifa. But if a person is transgressing because they're actively rejecting Judaism, you can't include them in a minyan, even if they haven't been put into cheirem. Now, in our case, you could say nowadays that a person who's married out, most people who marry out, or lots of people who marry out, maybe in his time it was a bit different, but lots of people marry out, it's not because they're making a conscious decision, they want to abandon everything to do with Judaism. They fell in love with a non-Jewish person and they don't care enough about Judaism to be bothered by it. But it's not they made the decision, I don't want to continue being Jewish and I want to marry out. So therefore, he thinks that maybe we could include them in a minyan. Ulam kvar ha'ela b'shut zichron Yehuda. She says davka b'smanehem. But he's now quoting the Zichron Yehuda, who says that only applied in the old days. Shayah shalahem l'nadot, when there was a possibility of excommunicating people. V'lachein mishelo nitnada mutal tzarfon. Therefore, a person who hasn't been excommunicated can be included in the minyan. Masha'ein kein bizmaneinu, but that's not the case nowadays. Shasol lanu al pichu kehamem shalal nadot. He says it's illegal to put people into cherem. Therefore, we need to look at the reasons rather than the actual status that a person has. Meaning, in the old days, would this person have been excommunicated? We're not interested in the fact that nowadays they haven't got they're not wearing a badge that says they're excommunicated. Would they, if we could excommunicate, would they be excommunicated? And in this instance, we definitely would have put such a person into cheirem, because of migdah milta, in order to prevent further assimilation and further intermarriage, and therefore it would not be permitted to include them in a minyan. So this is the position of the Sri Deish. Other subsequent poskim, some do endorse it, others have a more relaxed attitude. This is a very real question, if you're out in community in the middle of nowhere, where sometimes half your community is married out. If you don't include them in your minyan, then you're not going to have a minyan. And sometimes you can have shuls where I know of a provincial shul, very small community that I think only has services on Yamim Narayim, but the president of the shul is married out, and so he's the one who's happy to do to do the work. But so certainly as a starting point, the Sri Deish would not want us to include such a person in a minyan. Yeah, so that would also be part of the part of the consideration. And that's a discussion amongst contemporary rabbis about under what circumstances can you call up a person who's married out, under what circumstances can you call up a person who's married out. And different shuls, different synagogal bodies have different positions on that. A second question that he addressed, again reflecting perhaps a changing religious landscape, is the question: can a non-Orthodox rabbi be invited to lecture in an Orthodox shul? I'm not available one Tuesday night, so could we get in somebody from Leo Beck to take my place? So that's not quite the question that he's asking. Kvoz harav l'shelatoy mutar l'rav lo orthodoxy lahar top beit hakneset orthodoxy. So can a non-orthodox rabbi lecture in an orthodox shul? Im hu yimna mehabat deot b'shelot datiyot. That's providing, you obviously said, we don't want to hear, as a person who's, you could have a reform rabbi who's an expert on the Sri Deish. So we can, have this as a, he's written a doctoral thesis on the Sri Deish and a three-volume biography. So I want to give a shir on the Sri Deish. So could I have him come and give a lecture on the life and times of the Sri Deish, and then for me to give the shir on the Shelot and Shuvot? So he says that, the question is, we don't want his religious views. We don't want him assessing as to whether or not his Piskei Halakha are good, acceptable or not. But can you give us the historical, cultural background? So I sent you a telegram already saying that it's prohibited. Now I want to explain to you why that's the case. So he has two main considerations. Aleph, number one. To have a lecture in a shul which is not nothing to do with kedusha, that's prohibited in a shul. And he cites Shulchan Aruch for us. That's a shul is built there for religious purposes. And that's predominantly that's what it should be used for. Im halacha oseh vitur miyuchad l'rabbanim u'matira lahem l'haratzot b'beit ha'kneset gam al inyanim klaliim. Now, It might be that the halakha has a broad approach with regard to letting rabbonim give give lectures in shuls on wider subjects. So you know that's you know a rav could come in and give a lecture on the Sri Deish. Why would that be? Not a halakha, not go through his shelot and shuvot, but give you know the historical context, etc. Why would that be the case? Hare na seada vami pnei sheminichim sharatzato shel rav orthodoxy tiye chadura b'chol ofen ruach datit. That's if you've got an Orthodox rabbi coming in and giving a lecture here on the Sri Deish, you're going to learn Torah as well. You know, it's not just going to be that you know discussing when the Sri Deish wore a bow tie and when he wore a regular tie. So it's going to be about the religious motivation, you know, behind the Sri Deish's writings, etc., etc. And therefore, even if it's a whole lecture, we can assume that it's going to have a religious dimension to it and spur people to greater Yirat Shamayim. So that's his, you know, his main consideration. Now, of course, not every shul is going to be the same. So, you know, what he hasn't addressed is perhaps the question of you've got a shul with the shul hall. It's true, you know, in the shul proper, you couldn't have a lecture on the Jews of India, right? But in the shul hall, you could have such a lecture. Then you have questions about what's the status of our shul, you know. That's, you know, has this got the din of a Beit HaKnesset? Has this got the din of a function room in LSJS that we rent and, you know, where they need it for a function we clear out of here? You know, has this got Kedushat Beit HaKnesset or not is a different question. That's, but essentially he holds that, you know, a shul proper, certainly the sanctuary, should be used only for... for things which are associated with Kodesh and Kedusha. And then he goes on to say in his final paragraph that certainly the Kehillah where this question came from, Aschpenburg. So there it was a well-established, long-established community which had impeccable Orthodox credentials. And that was what people expected the shul to be used for, to promote orthodoxy and not to bring in non-orthodoxy. So those are his considerations. It's like kind of interesting that, you know, if we were taking his principles and applying them to the current context, we could say, okay, so based on what the Sri Deish says, the Sri Deish's conclusion here is you can't do it. So therefore, based on what he said, we would come to the conclusion that you can do it. Because we'd say most of our shuls, oh, they have a social hall, a function hall, whatever, as you know, really close. You know, you've got, so fine, you have the lecture in the community centre, not in the main shul. And, you know, to say that, you know, these are, you know, communities which have had, you know, centuries of commitment to the highest standards of orthodoxy, I'm not in any sense, you know, trying to cast aspersions on any of my colleagues in any way, but the orthodoxy, the outreach orthodoxy of 21st century United Synagogue is very different to the Yekish orthodoxy that, you know, was in German cities going back, you know, hundreds of years. So it's, you know, a very different setup. Well, he's working on assumption that we don't want to have a reform non-orthodox rabbis' religious views at all. That's you know, he does make that clear. That's and even in the you know opening sentence, imhu yimna mehavat deos b'sheilot datiot. We don't want to hear his religious views. So he's going to give his lecture on a secular subject. Or a non-religious section. You know, I don't suppose he's going to come and talk about, you know, Liverpool Football Club in the 1960s.
Right, so with that, there's no problem as long as it's not in the sanctuary.
Well, he was saying it's not in the sanctuary, and he's still, you know, unhappy about you know bringing in anything which he says is not you know mahadrin min hamahadrin. That's And you know, you might say it's kosher, but you definitely wouldn't say it's mahadrin min hamahadrin. Jake.
I think I read, I don't know if it's the first book, that he was kind of doing an about turn late on in life, a bit more pragmatic late on in life than he was earlier.
Certainly, it seems that, in his early years, he was, I would say he had a fully Haredi outlook. And in his later years, he had a more nuanced outlook.
Would these be considered to be early life, or I don't know?
I haven't got the dates on most of these. Most of these, I didn't take the dates. I took the dates out to give us a bit more space on the page. It's all jumbled around, so it doesn't really mean anything. Not sure. I mean, I think his later life was, you know, but once he became, you know, rector of the seminary in Berlin, that was all. And most of these Tshuvot were written, you know, in that period and later. So, you know, I think that you know, this is already reflecting the change. You know, you have to, you know, the situation is, as we discussed 2 weeks ago with Rav David Zvi Hoffman. You know, the realities in in Berlin. In Germany, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, you know, were very different to the realities that that we have today, in the sense that, and the realities anywhere else in the Jewish world, really, you know, totally different to what it was in Poland and Russia, you know, in Eastern Europe, in the sense that, you know, Orthodoxy was very small, okay. The small orthodoxy that there was very strong and very frum, right? So it's, you know, the dominant Kehillah was non-orthodox, right? But the orthodox Kehillah was, you know, was very strong, had, you know, very strong adherence to halacha. So it's, you know, a very different. It's hard to say what he would have said in our contemporary context, because, you know, in Anglo-Jewry, you know, in the 21st century, orthodoxy is still nominally the major denomination. On the other hand, by and large, the orthodoxy that, you know, we have is different to what, you know, German orthodoxy was, you know, in the 1920s. It's coming not so much from a tradition of centuries of orthodoxy, but it's rebuilding itself, and, you know, largely made up by people who, you know, haven't been orthodox for several generations, you know, going back. So it's a different, you know, different setup that we have. Reflecting changes, I think, is a key idea in his next tshuva. This is a very famous tshuva, about mixed youth groups, which they had in Germany at the time. He's actually referring to France, but they had in Germany, they had in France. It was mixed youth groups, so there was a social dimension to it. And part of it was, you know, Shabbat afternoon, they'd have Sudash Shashit, the boys and girls would sing Zmirot together, etc. And the background and the Psak are both very interesting. We won't go through every word, but it's worth studying this tshuva properly. B'miktav o miyom chet teveit. He's giving us the date. Derech hachinuch shel urgun yeshurun. Shenosad be'eret tzfat lifnei kamashanim. So there's a youth group called Yeshurun. Shehu mitnaheg al pi shita tachinuch shaya nahug bimdinas ashkenaz lifnei achurban. So he's writing this, obviously, post-Holocaust. He says the Churban, he means Churban Europa, not the Churban Beit HaMikdash. He says it's following the educational standards that we had in Germany. V'achshav kamu negdo ororim mitzad chug yadua shel charedim. There's a certain well-known group of charedim who are opposing this. Asher lefi da'atam ein haderech hazot lefi ruach ha-yahudut. They hold this isn't a Yiddish way of educating Yiddish kinderlach. In the traditions that, you know, this doesn't follow the traditions that we have from our forebears and previous generations of saintly rabbis. So the next paragraph, he tells us what the objections are. The objections are twofold. Number one, that it's a mixed group. And number two, that not only is it a mixed group, but they sing together. That's and those are the objections. Vashiva, third paragraph. Vashiva rishon rishon v'alacharon acharon. So let me go through the objections in order. So certainly the objections are valid objections. According to halacha, then needs to be a segregation between men and women. So there's no sense of frivolity. This is the whole sugya in the fourth parak of Masechet Sugya, which talks about in the Beit HaMikdash, where they put up the Simchat Beit HaShoeva. They separated between the men and the women, and eventually they had a balcony so that the men and women would be properly separated. And five lines down, we times then Nimnu b'chol kilot kudoshot v'yaseid chevrot. And therefore, it was always the minhag in all holy, sacred communities that they didn't have mixed social groups. So that's there is background to this demand. There should be a segregation of the sexes. Now, there's a lot of room to discuss what the parameters of that are. In the Beit HaMikdash, that was, in the Beit HaMikdash, a place of Kedusha, at the time of frivolity, the time of the Simchat Beit HaShoeva. So whether or not that translates to all contexts is a debatable question. But he suggests at least there's some background, some basis for that claim. And he says the second question about the mixed singing, there's a Gemara and a Halacha in Shulchan Aruch, Kol Be'isha Erva, that a woman's voice while singing is regarded as Erva, and therefore you've got serious problems. Now, his first way of dealing with it is to point out very clearly that the educational situation in Germany pre-war, in France post-war, is very different to what it was in Poland, in previous generations. Mikol makom, kishenishalti yishurun. When I was asked, when Yishurun came to discuss this with me, horeti lahem sheyam shichvet pulatam. I said they should carry on business as normal. Al pi haderch sheitvu lahem gedolei Ashkenaz. In accordance with the guidelines established in Germany, Shayut Sadikin Gedolim. In Germany, the Rabbonim were very frum. I don't know if very frum is an exact translation of Sadikin Gedolim, but in any event, everything they were doing was L'shem Shamayim. Natzilet Hanoa Misakanat Hatmi'a Shehit Pashta Ba'ashkenaz B'mehem. To save Jewish youth from assimilation, which was rampant in those days. And by having attractive youth groups, that saved a lot of people from assimilation. Ugdolei Ashkenaz hayu bekim u'mumchim b'chokhmat hachinuch. The Gedolim in Ashkenaz, they understood educational psychology very well. V'lachin hitznichu b'maseihem. Lakim dorot shleimim shel bale yirat shamayim. Paskalach hinonit ke'echad. They were able to have several generations of people who were very frum, very learned, very God-fearing, combining it with a broad secular education. And they were successful with that. That wasn't the case in Lithuania and Poland. He's quite sharp with this language. He's saying that in Germany, they were able to understand what was needed educationally. He says in Poland, they had no idea. They just, pull your strimal down over your eyes, carry on like nothing had ever changed. Whereas in Germany, he says they understood that a different generation called for a different educational approach. So he says there's a story about Rebbe Yisrael Salanter, b'shuvo me'ashkenaz, when he went back home after visiting Germany. In Germany, he'd met with Rebbe Asriel Hildesheimer, one of the great German poskim, the year of Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. He saw that Rebbe Asriel Hildesheimer gave shiurim, Torah Shebaal Peh, Torah Shebichtav, the whole ganze Geschäft, right? In front of young women and unmarried women. And this is what he said. If any of the Lithuanian rabbonim was to even think about doing this, he'd be chased out of town before he could say Aseret B'nei Aman. And that's correct. So it should be. We're not standing for any of this where we come from. I'd still like to be sitting next to Rebbe Asriel in Gan Eden. It's because the moment demands it. It might be not traditional Rabbonus to do this, but the Chatam Sofer would have been unable to write a tshuva if he'd known of these things that were going on. That's mixed groups chas v'chalila. But times have moved on, and if we want to involve the next generation of young people in exciting Judaism, then there needs to be a modern style youth groups. And the Polish and Hungarian rabbonim who ended up in France, they see what even the Haredim rabbonim in France are doing. They're following these German minhagim, but hey, mochim negdam ba'oz, and they're shrying gevalt about it. It's against Shas and Poskim. However, ein harabim hanal bekiim b'tnai hachayim hashorerim b'mdinat Tsarfat. These rabbis, they just don't understand what's going on in France. They can't understand that this isn't, Vilna in 1763. They just don't understand how desperate the situation is. Lehepech. And he says, on the contrary, what they're trying to do is going to endanger the next generation much more. And it's kind of interesting, this is very, harif language. I don't think many Orthodox rabbis, would be so openly critical in print, he could have just written, times have changed, but no, these rabbis, they've got no idea of what chinuch should be about. So he's batting very strongly. On the other hand, he's got a problem here in terms of circumstances have changed, but of course the halacha doesn't change. And if there's cogent halachic grounds to say that this is asa, then it's going to remain asa. It's not going to, just because we've got problems, doesn't mean to say that you can throw Shas and Shulchan Aruch out of the window. So he makes a number of observations. But it's again, it's worth noting in his next paragraph, Lefitior, so Kavod Torato, Yoshim Habanim Vabanot Bi Cheder Echad. So it's a mixed group. The guys and the girls are in the same room. Avala Inam Yoshim Asasal Echad Yachad. They certainly don't sit on the same benches. Ela Shehim Sharim Shirei Kodesh Psukei Tanach Zmirot Shabbat Biachad. But they sing Jewish songs together. Shwekis Vehisha Amda. When they go on camp, they're separate wings or buildings for the boys and the girls. The shiurei Torah are not mixed. Va'amadrichim shehem yirei shamayim. The madrichim are all good, God-fearing individuals, and medaktikim v'mitzvot, very from. Mekablim achrayot shelo yitaylu habanim v'abanot yachad. They make sure that the when they go out, it's not the the boys and the girls aren't mixing together. Imlo ba'ofen meurgan b'hashkachat hamadrichim, unless that they're being carefully chaperoned and supervised by the madrichim. So I want to be careful what I'm saying, but he's not describing contemporary Bnei Akiva. That's he's describing, I think, something a little bit to the right of contemporary Bnei Akiva, and it's that kind of kedai to bear that in mind. Well, how's he going to deal with the halachic realities? So he says that in his next paragraph he addresses the Gemara Masechet Sukkah, which is talking about the takana that they had in the Beit HaMikdash. And he says, number one, it's clear that they had a separation, and they had the women upstairs and the men downstairs, but there certainly wasn't a mechitza there to stop the men and women looking at each other in any sense. He says, in Shul's different. Shul has a mechitza because you've got davening going on there, etc., etc. But in a social environment, then you don't need to have a mechitza. In an environment of kedusha, where you're saying tefillah, kriyat shema, then you need a proper mechitza, so the men and the women can't see each other. But in terms of other contexts, then there doesn't need to be the same degree of separation. It might be segregation rather than separation, etc. And so that's his main consideration as far as the mixed group is concerned, is that if it's not shat tefillah, then you don't need full separation between the sexes. And of course, this is I think quite well known that in Yekish German Dutch circles, in pre-war times, weddings were mixed events. The men and women sat at the same tables, whereas in Eastern European Orthodoxy, that was unheard of, and they weren't mixed events. And this is a part of a contemporary discussion. Is it right that smachot should be should be mixed or separate? And very often bringing the views of the or at least the practice in Germany, that even in the Frumkehillot in Germany, that it was mixed seating at functions because it's not shat tefillah, and therefore there's no problem in having mixed seating. That's interestingly, just as an aside, there's Rav Henkin has a tshuva on the subject of mixed seating at weddings. He has two tshuvas. In his first tshuva, he speaks out against mixed seating and is of the opinion there should be separate seating. That's in his second tshuva, I think he's more. Or maybe in both of his tshuvot, he says it's all right to have separate, to have mixed seating, but the singles should have separate seating. In terms of married couples can sit on mixed tables at weddings, but the singles shouldn't. But then in a subsequent tshuva, he says he's rethought it, and he agrees that the singles shouldn't. That only applies to the teenagers. The older singles, he thinks it's a very good idea that they should sit at mixed tables, because they might meet the right person in the right environment. In any event, so in terms of the mixed group, he's not too bothered about. In terms of the singing together, he cites halachic considerations from Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer and Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, that they allowed it, and their halachic consideration was a principle of trei kale lo mishtame. That we've generally speaking got a view in Shas that if two voices are concurrent with each other. So then you can't clearly identify either of them. So that's like, for example, in a halakhic context, you've got two people reciting Kiddush together, you know, on Friday night, then the people listening aren't Yotzei because they can't make out the voice of either one of them. So when you've got more than one voice, the voices aren't really so discernible. So I suggest that that's a grounds to be grounds for leniency in this case, and also quotes from the Stechemed in the name of a Rav Sfaradi that Zmirot Kodesh is going to be permitted because it's there that the whole purpose is L'shem Shamayim. And he brings a raya from the Shir of Devorah. What's the opening words of the Shir of Devorah? Haftar for Parshat B'Shalach. V'atashar Devorah uvarak ben Avi Noam. It's both Dvorah and Barak ben Avinoam were singing this, or certainly Dvorah was singing, and it was Divrei Kodesh, so a combination of the two factors, that it's Divrei Kedusha and that it's Trei Kaleh, so motivates him to be lenient. And he says that, you know, this was the minhag under the auspices of Rav Hildesheimer, Rav Hirsch, you know, that Zmirot at the Shabbat table, you know, the women would join in as well, out of a consideration that, you know, you don't want to push the women away from this spiritual dimension of Shabbat. It might have worked well in Poland in the 19th century, but it wasn't working well in Germany in the 19th and 20th centuries, and doesn't necessarily work well in our communities either. So I think he's certainly saying his starting point would be, I think he's got a lot of sympathy with the claims of the Haredim, but at the same time, he, you know, feels that the circumstances demand that there should be leniency. Yeah, yeah. I think he felt that, you know, it's and he says actually, I've taken out the last part of the tshuva, and he actually says, but you know, those women who don't want to participate, no pressure should be brought on them. That, and you know, you don't need to. Oh no, it's fine. The Sri Dayesh says it's mutter. Why are you being so frum? That's, you know, that's a very, you know, well-grounded position. So I think, you know, he's saying, you know, I don't, you shouldn't go into Meir Shearim and, you know, set up mixed groups, you know, where there's really no need for it. In the France, in the 1940s, 1950s, it was Eit Lasot Lashem. It was critical. And I guess each community has to, you know, look at its own, you know, own situation, what's, you know, what's necessary, you know, etc., with a, you know, both a short-term goal and a long-term goal, you know, in mind. You know, what's correct and right in one context won't necessarily be correct and right in another context. But, you know, this is a much quoted, you know, position of the Three Day Age, and quite often misquoted, in the sense that it's clear from the Tshuva, he's not giving it a blanket heter. He's not saying, oh, you know, there's no problem with mixed groups, there's no problem with mixed thinking. As he's saying, there's grounds to be lenient and to permit it when the circumstances demand. And, you know, in many, you know, many contexts, the, you know, circumstances, you know, demand that. You know, I think, you know, you know, again, depending on the context, you know, of one's community, etc. But you know, I think I think in our type of community, that, you know, to tell the you know, the women folk, okay, at the Shabbos table, the men will sing Zmirot and you know, get excited about the spirituality of you know, of Shabbat, and they can enjoy the singing. The women, you know, can either sit there discussing Hello Magazine or clear the tables. That's I don't think that's a long term solution to you know, to keeping people involved in orthodoxy in our community. In other communities, it might work very well. But you know, so and we certainly got the tuba of the Sri Daesh that we can rely on. The next tuba, which we'll just touch on briefly because the time is already beginning to run out, was addressed in the 1950s to Rabbi Leo Jung, who was the rabbi of the Jewish Center in New York. And he was considering having parts of the service recited in English. I don't know whether that was that people should say them, you know, to themselves in English, or that congregational recitations in English. Either way, that's wants to know if that's good practice. Shalom uvracha. V'ashesh al kavod ol lechavot da'ati b'davar ha'sheila. So you want to know my view? Im lahanigam irat mizmorim b'tochat tefillah b'lashon anglit. So can you have various mizmorim in English? Zuhi sheila adina ma'od. This is a very sensitive question. Mitzad hadin. So halachically, v'vaday she'in kanisul. It's definitely permissible. No issur at all. Chayat tefillot ne'emarot b'chol lashon. Prayers can be said in any language whatsoever. And even those poskim who say that in general you shouldn't, but they're makel for women. They're makel for women because in their generation the women couldn't read Hebrew. And he refers us to Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Berurah. V'ulam baroni kishemesh. It's as clear as day to me. Shacharedim yitnagdu lo. So again, it's kind of interesting. You're going to get, the Charedim are all going to drive you meshuggah over this. V'yotziu alav kol shu min ha-mataklin. They're going to call you a reformer. Chas v'sholom. V'yimtzu anashim ba'alei kinash, v'yimtzu makom lehitkadev, v'yotziu laz v'rinun. And you'll find all sorts of kanaim. We've got, again, all sorts of rumors are going to be set up about you. They're going to say that I don't know, you wear a blue shirt and a kippah sugar. That Shevetah Knesset Shalom it's Palim Blashon Anglit. They're going to say, oh, you know, Jewish center, oh, they daven in English. That's interesting. Saying, why upset the Haredim? That's what he's saying. He's saying, don't do it because they're going to drive you mad. He's saying, don't, you know, why upset them? You know, they're very sensitive to religious change, and for good reason, and don't upset them. Which is, you know, kind of interesting in the context of public public policy. He then goes on in the next paragraph to talk about the view of the Chatam Sofer, who says that even if you can recite prayers in the vernacular, that's only going to be by cry on an occasional basis. You can't say, okay, you know, we're always going to say Pesukei Dezimra in English. You know, you can't do that. And he also says that, you know, that the synagogue is the last bastion of true, authentic Judaism. And if you're going to water that down, then you've got no chance of survival. So it might be okay, you know, you want to tell people, you know, say the Friday night benching in English. You know, fine. But in terms of shul, shuls should always be adhering to the highest standards and doing what's absolutely right. And then he goes on to say in the final paragraph that you know, there's additional reasons to prohibit it. It's not minhag avotenu, and you know that tefillah has always been in Hebrew and should always be in Hebrew. So it's like kind of interesting because this tshuva is in a certain sense a reversal of the previous tshuva. The previous tshuva, he was saying that, well, you know, from a strict halachic perspective, there's good grounds for saying that there's a big problem with these mixed groups and the mixed singing. And it's only because, you know, I'm looking for heterim that it's going to be permitted. Right? Whereas here he's saying, from a strict halachic perspective, there's no problem at all. But my, you know, shikul adat on the subject is that it's going to be prohibited. And in both cases, of course, he's looking at, you know, the wider picture in terms of what's right, you know, for this generation. You know, he felt it was right, you know, mixed groups was right, but turning shuls into, you know, lowering the standards of shuls that, you know, well, you know, people can't read Hebrew, so, okay, well, you know, why push them to read Hebrew? Let's, you know, let's start having our services in English. You know, it's not the way we want to go. Even though, of course, it was never being suggested the whole service. You know, I suppose, you know, read one Mizmor together in English or something. You know, it might be that, you know, read Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbat together in English. You know, for the benefit of those who can't read Hebrew. But he was clearly very resistant to that. Let's just touch quickly on a couple of other points. He's got a tshuva here which addresses, this was written in 1932 to the Rav of Oslo, where it seems, and we touched on this, you know, last 2 weeks ago. These were issues that Rav David Tzvi Hoffman was addressed. Sorry, no, last week. This was also, yeah, it was Switzerland and Sweden that the Rav Chaim Ozer was writing to, where they'd, in the early 1930s, they'd prohibited Shechita without stunning. I think perhaps in Sweden, it seems from this tshuva, they'd actually prohibited Shechita. So he says, well, you know, what about, you know, you've got a shochet who's happy to shecht around the back of the shul or something. That's what about dina de malchuta dina? It's illegal to have shechita. So, you know, is that going to be a problem? So he's got an interesting approach. He says, dina de malchuta dina has got nothing to do with ritual issues. Dina malchuta dina, and this is the view of many, if not, you know, most poskim, dina de malchuta dina, that you have to follow the law of the land, you know, is generally applied to, you know, taxation, civil law, you know, such things. I can't put up I can't build, you know, an extension to my house without getting planning permission, all those sorts of things. I'm not allowed to speed on the motorway, maybe, such things. In terms of, you know, religious issues, Dina de Malchuta Dina's got nothing to do with that. He said you've got to be careful that's you don't want it done under the auspices of the Kehillah. That's his recommendation is Dati he Ktov Torato Yalim Eti Nav Mehadavar Yaset Smoki Eino Yodah. Close your eyes. You don't want to know what's going on. But then if you're asked about it wasn't under your auspices, you know, just stand back and find there's an elderly shochet who's shechting. Fine, let him, you know, don't get involved, and then you won't get into trouble. You won't be pulled into court for allowing it under your auspices. People who want the kosher meat will have it. It's not a problem with Dina de Malchuta Dina. The second issue that he discusses in the same shuva is whether or not women should be enfranchised with the vote. That's in communal elections. He says min hadin, there's no reason to prohibit it, even though Reb David Tzvi Hoffman, he says, did prohibit it. Relations min hadin, there's no reason to prohibit it. He says mikol makom his kamin lekulanu, where there was a rabbinic meeting of German rabbonim, we all agreed that it's against min hag Yisrael. And he's quite clear that's not the role of Jewish women. His view is, which is kind of interesting, again, you know, compare and contrast it with the tshuva about the mixed groups, you know, where he's got quite a broad-minded attitude. Here, though, of course, there's probably the best part of 20 years in between the writing of these two tshuvot and the Shoah in the middle, right, which, you know, just changed the whole Jewish world. But writing in 1932... He was against it. That's not the role of Jewish women to be involved in Jewish communal politics. That's and he's against it. But in his final paragraph, he says, if it's going to cause a whole communal broigus, you know, then allow it. And so, you know, if they're asking your opinion, you've got the chance to give a psak halacha. I think you should pass them against it. If it's going to bring the Kehillah tumbling down, you know, that the Rav said he can't have it, so I mean, Adin, it's permitted. But, he's not happy with it. And again, this is, you know, one of the tshuvot which is, you know, cited in the context of, contemporary orthodoxy, both with regard to women, you know, being allowed to vote, you know, for the Board of Management and to stand for the Board of Management. Etc. You know, and it's one of these wonderful tshuvot where you can, you can bring the Sri Daesh, who says not to do it, as a proof that you can do it, or the other way around as well, in terms of, because, yeah, he's saying because, you know, in those circumstances, it's not Minhag Yisrael, it's not right, but times have changed, so it's clear that he would have gone along with the change. Or he's saying, no, it's, those are against it. Even the 3-day Eish says it's, you know, it's against the din.
This is only about a decade or so after when we got the vote in England or in Britain.
In any case,
I mean, that's quite a current topic of the time. And
Right. That's, you would always expect there to be, greater conservatism.
It's not as though that this view is backward in a world,
Correct. If it's only been 10 years that women have been allowed to vote in Great Britain, then you would expect, the rabbinic establishment to be, a little bit behind, considerably behind that. I'm not saying that in a negative sense, but we don't generally pride ourselves as being at the, at the front of, innovating sociological change. So, there are a few left-wingers who do, but, essentially that's not, orthodoxy is, generally prefers to maintain the status quo till it's no longer sustainable. That's where the point of conflict often comes. And that's, in the previous tshuva, that's really what he was saying, that the point of conflict between the Polish and Lithuanian rabbonim and the German rabbonim was, at what point is it no longer sustainable in its old way? The question of the child of the Jewish father and Gentile mother being converted, can it be accepted into a Jewish school? Got a lot of contemporary relevance to it. Discusses the question, as the mother's not converting, but the father wants to convert the child. Is that permissible? Speaks about min hadin, you can convert a child, even if the mother's not going to convert. But he's very strongly against it, because he says the whole reason, generally speaking, with the conversion, the ger needs to have kabbalat mitzvot. A child hasn't got the ability to be mekabel on mitzvot. But we say that the bet din, or the parents, the bet din can convert a child, as it were, on his behalf, because it's a zechut for a child, for a person to become Jewish. You get all sorts of wonderful spiritual benefits. But he says that's only true if you're converting a child into an environment where they're going to become religiously observant. There's no point converting a child into an environment where they're going to, being b'chalal Shabbat and eat treif and not keep any mitzvot, because then it becomes a chovah, because then they're Jewish, but they're Jewish and they're breaking all the mitzvot in the Torah. That's a terrible thing. So he says not to, in that sort of situation, not to convert the children, but, until they've reached at least their teenage years and they can make a decision themselves. But he says they can be accepted into the Jewish school system with that goal in mind. And if they've had a Brit Milah already, then that's a valid Brit Milah. They don't have to have Hatafat Dam Brit. But I'm sure this was, all those involved in the issues with JFS a couple of years back, etc., I'm sure we're aware of the view of the 3-day Eish on this, and others as well who take this this view. But again, you can't compare one context with another context. In his context, he felt that it was fine to accept them into a Jewish school. Current context suggested to those who were making the decisions, suggested otherwise. The final tshuva, which we won't go into again properly inside, is a question, and again, this is really interesting. This was, it doesn't have a date on it either, but this was again in pre-war Germany. So can you do a tahara for a person who's being cremated? Nowadays, the reality, and these cremation was a big issue that bothered the German poskim. Cremation was becoming popular, and they were fighting very strongly against it. But you know, it's kind of bizarre, you know, nowadays, you know, I've, over the course of, you know, my 20 years as a rabbi, I've had, you know, not Baruch Hashem, not whilst I've been in Al Etzion, but, you know, in previous communities, you know, happens that people, you know, relatives of members have been cremated, and, you know, trying to get the cremation, you know, stopped, etc. And without exception, every single case where a person's cremated, it's the person is, you know, they weren't a member of a shul, they had no interest in anything Jewish, and they wanted to be cremated, really as a last way of, or often in a as a last way of opting out of the Jewish community. And certainly, you know, as a signal they had no interest in anything anything halachic. That's the German poskim were dealing with a different question. You know, who being cremated would want to have a tara done on them? You know, the tara is so important to them, but so they still got this religious dimension. You know, but cremation is fine. There's, you know, discussion in the past. Can you bury the ashes of a cremated person in a Jewish cemetery? You know, and those, you know, I've never come. In truth, is the reform cremate and will bury the ashes in their cemetery. But, you know, I've never come across all the, you know, cremations that I've come across. They've got no interest. You know, they want the ashes to be scattered over the rose bushes. You know, nothing more than that. That's the German poskim. You know, there's this whole question about, you know, there's a common belief that if a person's cremated, you don't sit shiva for them. Okay, whereas that was a takana of the German poskim in the 19th century. Right, to discourage people from being cremated, right? Meaning that people, they believe that if you tell people that if you're cremated, your family won't sit shiva for you, that would stop them being cremated. But as I say, everybody who I've ever known of who's been cremated, they've got no interest in their family sitting shiva for them. They believe it's ecologically better. It's a bit cheaper to be cremated. It's cheaper to be cremated. But, you know, I mean, there are all sorts of... You can have your dad on your mantelpiece. That's, there are all sorts of reasons. What I'm saying is, I've never come at, you know, it's just kind of interesting that there was this sort of straddling two worlds. Yeah, you know, I want, you know, Tara and Tachrichim, you know, in accordance with, you know, Minhag Yisrael, and then I want to be burnt. You know, yeah, to us it's bizarre, but that wasn't the case. And the truth is, you know, these are, you know, if looking at the Shuvot from the German Poskim Bichlal, you know, we've seen, I think, you know, repeatedly instances of, think, you know, where, you know, they were trying, you know, some of the reformers were just, you know, not interested in Torah or Judaism at all. But within the Orthodox community, there was a move towards reform within bounds of halakha, which, you know, doesn't really exist nowadays. I mean, maybe the conservative movement, you know, is the closest equivalent. But, you know, in terms of Orthodox, you know, non-Orthodox practices being suggested, you know, within an Orthodox, you know, context. You know, we saw certain examples a couple of weeks ago with Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. So here, you know, no. Anyhow, his conclusion is that if they don't want to be buried Jewish, then, you know, if they want to be cremated, you don't have anything to do with them at all. If the ashes are going to be buried, it shouldn't be buried with, you know, under rabbinic supervision, you know, etc., etc. And really stay clear of it. This, okay. So that's, again, it's, you know, a different religious, sociological reality. Next week, we're up to Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think next week's the seventh year in the series. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how seeing, you know, sort of each one leading, you know, from the Nozab Yehuda, Chatham Sofer, each one leading on, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, the next generation after the three days. You know, last week we saw the Achiezer, who died in 1940, the three days this week died in 1966, next week Rav Moshe Feinstein, who died in 1985 or 86, 86, 87, that's, and you know, all of them linked to each other. You know, the three days he's got, you know, tshuvot and responses, you know, correspondence in, you know, published correspondence between him and Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski got between him and the previous generation. And, you know, this is really one of the wonderful things about Masorah is, you know, how, you know, everybody's learning from their rabbis who were linked in with the previous generation. Adkan.
Good thing.